Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 28th of March, these are our main stories. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has postponed plans to overhaul the judicial system after unprecedented protests. A heavily armed woman has killed 6 people, including children, at a school in the US state of Tennessee. The UN has described Ukraine as one of the world's biggest minefields after a year of war. Also in this podcast,
I heard something I've never heard at a ski resort, and that was a blood-curdling scream. Just, I can't do it. And then, boom.
The man suing the actress Gwyneth Paltrow gives evidence in the case over who caused a skiing collision 7 years ago. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced that he will delay judicial reforms that have caused the biggest wave of public protest in his country's history. In a televised speech to the nation on Monday evening, Mr. Netanyahu said the delay until the next session of parliament would enable dialogue and avoid civil war.
And I say, here and now, there must not be a fratricidal war. We are on the path of a dangerous collision in Israeli society. We are in the midst of a crisis that endangers the basic unity among us. Such a crisis requires us all to act responsibly.
The controversial plans, which drastically limit the independence of Israel's courts, have divided Israelis, with opponents accusing the Prime Minister of behaving like a dictator. Three months of massive protests culminated in nationwide strikes on Monday that brought the country to a standstill after Mr. Netanyahu fired his defense minister at the weekend for breaking ranks. Flights were grounded, with unions, hospitals, universities, shopping malls and even diplomats taking part in the strike action. Mr. Netanyahu's far-right allies have been demonstrating too, in favour of his reforms. The finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, was attending a rally before the prime minister spoke and urged supporters to join him.
Friends, we must not halt the reform that aims to repair the judicial system and reinforce Israeli democracy. We are the majority. We must not capitulate in the face of violence, anarchy, the refusal to serve in the armed forces, and the wild strikes. We are the majority. Let's make our voice heard. Let's get together tonight in front of the Knesset. I'll be there. Come as well. We won't let them steal our voice or our country.
So just how much of a climb down is this by the Israeli Prime Minister? Anna Foster is our correspondent in Jerusalem.
It is not what he wanted to do, and he made it clear just a few days ago that he was going to try and push this legislation through along with his right-wing nationalist coalition partners. He did not want to pause at this stage. The current Knesset session ends at the end of this week before Passover, and he really did have ambitions to get this legislation through before then. What he has had to do is pause, but this is really crucial. The vocabulary that's being used here is important, because what the demonstrators wanted was a wholesale scrapping of this legislation. A pause, halt, freeze, whatever you may call it, was not what they had in mind. Now, Israeli opposition leaders have said that they will take this period of time to engage in fresh dialogue, that they will speak to Benjamin Netanyahu about this. What we don't know is what is likely to change in that time. Everybody, I think, across the spectrum have made their various feelings about this legislation felt. Many of those protesters, I was in a crowd with them at 2 o'clock this morning outside the Knesset, and democracy, along with shame, are two of the things you will hear them chant the most, because they really feel that this plan is eroding Israel's democracy. Benjamin Netanyahu, on the other hand, says that it's important that these balances happen, and he says he is restoring the balance, not throwing it off kilter.
So the Prime Minister doesn't want what the Israeli president said could amount to a civil war. He doesn't want his ruling coalition to break up either. What are his chances, do you think, of keeping both sides happy with this holding pattern?
He's really got a tightrope to walk. I mean, I think the reason that he has come out with this sticking plaster solution tonight rather than something which actually solves the problem once and for all demonstrates how difficult it's going to be to try and please both sides. Now, in terms of his right-wing coalition partners, the Jewish Power Party and Itamar Ben-Gvir, the National Security Minister, said tonight that they have been promised a new National Guard that Itamar Ben-Gvir would run. So it seems that Benjamin Netanyahu has tried to bring in a degree of trading and said, look, we can't do this, but what about this? You know, he knows he needs to keep those coalition partners on side. Otherwise, he does not have enough MKs with him. He does not have a ruling majority, and ultimately he loses power. So he knows he has to keep them on side. But equally, if you look at the sheer disruption in Israeli society today, that strike that saw shops and banks closed, the airport, ports, hospitals saying they would only treat emergency patients, it really came to a head tonight, and Benjamin Netanyahu had to act. But what he's done is delayed this problem rather than solving it.
Anna Foster. Well, among those who've been demonstrating against the government is the writer and historian Yuval Noah Hariri. Speaking before Mr. Netanyahu announced he was delaying the judicial reforms, he accused the government of perpetrating a coup.
When we hear coup, we think about tanks in the streets. But this is a coup coming from above. It's a very common phenomenon in history that a government that reached power in a legal way is then using its power to basically take away all restrictions on itself and gain unlimited power. You first use the law to gain power, then you use your power to dismantle the law. And this is what the government is now trying to do. If you find the situation confusing, there is really just one key question you should ask. What limits the power of the government? The only thing that limits the power of an Israeli government is really the Supreme Court. We have no constitution. There is no Senate or upper chamber. There is no federal system. And now the government is trying to gain control of the Supreme Court. If it succeeds, there is no longer any mechanism in Israel that limits its power. So, for example, if it wants to pass a law taking voting rights away from Arab citizens, and they have been talking about such things, there would be no legal mechanism to prevent it, which also means that they can rig the next elections in any way they like, and basically we will never be able to replace them.
Well, you asked the question, who controls the government? And of course, the voters do in the end, don't they? And I suppose the problem for you is that the voters keep putting governments like this in office.
No, I mean, the problem is that once the Supreme Court is neutralized by the government, they can change the electoral system in any way they like. And they have been already talking about this also. And we saw it in other countries, like in Turkey, like in Russia. I mean, they have elections in Russia. It's still not a democracy. In Russia, the elections are just a ceremony for the dictatorship. And we are in the same danger here in Israel. Again, there is nothing that will prevent them from taking voting rights from Arabs. There is nothing that will prevent them, for instance, from closing down all opposition newspapers and radio stations. And then it's not you can still have an election as a ceremony, but there is no real chance of getting rid of this government, no matter what it does.
It's really interesting because, of course, in the UK, our parliament is sovereign. In effect, our parliament, with a majority, can vote down Supreme Court decisions by passing a law that changes the law and renders those decisions obsolete or out of date. So I suppose the culture, the democratic culture, is what you ultimately rely on, in this country at least, to hold things under control. I just wonder whether you could rely on that in Israel.
No, Israel is a very, very polarized society. As you know, we also hold millions of Palestinians under occupation. We have hundreds of thousands of messianic zealots who believe in Jewish supremacy. Also, we are not subject to any international bodies or laws. You know, I heard people compare the situation in Israel to Hungary, but Hungary is still a member of the European Union. Israel is a major military power. It has nuclear weapons. It is one of the leading cyber powers on the planet that can basically struck anywhere in the world. An undemocratic Israel would not be anything like Hungary.
Yuval Noach Hariri. It's horribly familiar and yet different. Three children and three adults have been killed in the latest school shooting in the United States, this time in the state of Tennessee. But the shooter who was also killed was not a man, but a woman. The 28-year-old is believed to have been a former student at the school. Shondell Brooks' son is a pupil there. He wasn't harmed, but she described the moment she got the call from his school.
I felt like my nerves left me. It felt like it was happening all over again. No parent should have to receive that call. No parent should have to go through anything like that.
We got more details from our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
The police have actually revealed quite a lot of information over the last hour or so. The person they say was responsible for this has been named as a 28-year-old woman, Audrey Hale, who lived in the area. They have been to her home. She lived with her parents. They've interviewed her father. And perhaps significantly, they say they found evidence of quite a significant amount of planning ahead of this attack, including maps of the school. They also say that they found what's described as a manifesto, writings of the suspect, that although they didn't go into details, suggests that it may give them, the investigators, some clues as to the motives for this attack. They say that the attacker had acted alone. They say there was no evidence of mental illness in her history, and that in fact she was indeed a former student of the school. We've also had confirmation over the last hour of the six victims, the six people that died, three adults in their 60s, Cynthia Peake, Catherine Koontz, who is the head teacher, and Mike Hill, and the three children, Evelyn Dykhouse, Hayley Scruggs, and William Kinney. 9-year-olds, one was eight, just about to turn nine.
So many shootings like this, but this one is rare because it was carried out by a woman.
It is very unusual. In fact, looking at some data that's available to us in 2021, this is information from the FBI, 61 mass shootings, only one was carried out by a woman. So yes, in that sense, very unusual. But tragically, what is not unusual about this is that it is yet another mass shooting, yet another school shooting in the United States that has left clearly so many people in this country angry and very concerned.
Peter Bowes. The Chinese billionaire Jack Ma is perhaps the most high-profile name in a long list of tycoons and financiers to have recently disappeared from public life in China. It's all linked to President Xi's anti-corruption crackdown on big tech companies, which has left many private companies reluctant to invest in China. Now, after keeping a low profile for the last 3 years, Mr. Ma has been seen visiting a school in China. So why has he suddenly emerged? And why did he disappear in the first place? We asked our Asia Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
Jack Ma disappeared in 2020, shortly after criticising Chinese financial regulators. It was just before his company, Ant Group, which has a mobile payment system in China, was due to go public, launch an IPO. That was suddenly cancelled. Jack Ma disappeared. He wasn't arrested or anything, but he just didn't appear in public for quite a few months. And that's really continued over the last couple of years. It's thought that for the last year, he's actually been outside of China. And now suddenly he's appeared back in China at a school in Hangzhou where he was born, where his company is headquartered. And we're not exactly sure what's been happening in the intervening period.
And why do we think he's back now?
That's a good question. He's not saying, his company's not saying. His foundation issued a statement saying Jack Ma travels across China, across the world, and just making out that it was one of those things. But of course, it isn't. It's tempting with a lack of information to draw our own conclusions. And one of the conclusions that could be drawn is that over recent months, the Chinese leadership has spoken once again about being an encouraging place for entrepreneurs and trying to get private companies to invest more and to work more because the Chinese economy has just had 3 years of COVID lockdowns. It's looking to expand as quickly as it can. So many are seeing the reappearance of Jack Ma as a sign that the Chinese government wants to show that it's welcoming to entrepreneurs at this moment.
But how likely is that to work, given the fact that it seems that even the man who was once considered to be China's richest business person seems to be under government control?
Exactly, because you could actually draw the reverse conclusion. Since he fell foul of the regulators or annoyed the Communist Party in China a couple of years ago, Jack Ma not only has disappeared, but he's now lost control of his business empire, really. Just earlier this year, Ant Group, this financial company which he founded and he had a controlling stake in, well, that changed its structure. So Jack Ma went from having more than 50% control of the company to having about 6% control of the company. So essentially what the Chinese Communist Party has done has really neutered him, has shown that even the most powerful business person in the country can be stopped in their tracks if they get too powerful.
Michael Bristow. A man suing the Oscar-winning actress Gwyneth Paltrow over a skiing collision 7 years ago has been giving evidence in the case. The retired optometrist, Terry Sanderson, is claiming $300,000 for what he says were life-altering injuries caused by her skiing into him. Ms. Paltrow denies causing the collision and is countersuing. Nomia Iqbal reports.
Plaintiff, you may call your next witness.
It was a hit and run on the ski slope that this man says destroyed his life. 76-year-old Terry Sanderson claims Gwyneth Paltrow was reckless.
Everything was great, and then I heard something I've never heard at a ski resort, and that was a blood-curdling scream. Just, I can't do it. It was, and then, boom.
They had never met, but collided at the very upscale Deer Valley Resort in Utah back in 2016.
Why'd you tell her to leave?
Mr. Sanderson teared up, telling the court how his injuries had changed his relationships with his children and contributed to his split from his partner.
And I said, I'm not sure I'm going to get back to normal again. And I don't want you to feel like I'm a crippled vet and you're going to stick it out with me.
As well as those injuries, Mr. Sanderson says he can no longer enjoy wine tasting and has been suffering from another personality inhabiting his body.
It's the other personality that's inhabiting my body right now.
And you blame Gwyneth Paltrow for that?
Yes.
Gwyneth Paltrow has already spoken, accusing Terry Sanderson of being at fault.
I was skiing and two skis came between my skis, forcing my legs apart, and then there was a body pressing against me.
It basically comes down to skiing etiquette. Who was the downhill skier and had right of way? Gwyneth Paltrow's children, Apple and Moses, are set to testify before a jury is expected to decide later this week.
Nomia Iqbal. Still to come.
This is the Wicked Witch of the West. She's worse than the other one was.
Who killed my sister? Who killed the Witch of the East? Was it you?
No.
The growing calls to stop fictional villains from being portrayed as ugly or disabled.
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season two.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
When the Syrian uprising began 12 years ago, many never dreamed they would still be suffering the consequences today. Around 1 million Syrians have sought refuge in Lebanon, where in a country that is itself going through a dire economic crisis, Syrians are at the bottom of the poverty ladder. Many refugees, including children, have had to resort to recycling waste in the capital, Beirut, simply to earn enough to survive. Lina Sinjab sent this report from Lebanon.
A 26-year-old Dairi is picking out plastic from a litter bin by a seaside avenue in Beirut. bare hands and no protective clothing, he pushes his body deep inside the bin, opening plastic rubbish bags in search for recyclable items. Desperate for any earnings, some people are taking on this poorly paid unofficial work.
I start at 8:30 every morning. I work for 12 hours and I earn just $2 or $3 a day.
Deri and his wife Yamama have three children. They all live in one bedroom in an apartment they share with two other families. The minute he arrives back home, he starts cuddling with his children. I asked him if what he makes is enough.
I can't afford to send my kids to school or to give them a good life. We are hardly getting by, but it's better than humiliating myself begging on the street.
Half of his earnings go towards the rent. He and his fellow workers come from Raqqa in northern Syria. They escaped the war and the militant Islamic State group. And arriving in Lebanon, this is the only job they could secure. Most Syrian refugees in Lebanon are used to carry out poorly paid casual work. In recent years, and due to financial crisis, the workers who came from Bangladesh and were paid in US dollars have been replaced with Syrians who receive very little for such work.
We're just by one of the dumping places where the plastic and other garbage are recycled and stored here before being sold. And I can't even describe to you the smell. It's suffocating. Imagine for them, this is the reality they live in, day out, without any hygiene measures. But for many of them, there is no other choice.
A building above the dump is now home to several men, all from Raqqa. They are too scared to talk, too scared to be interviewed. They say they fear being deported back to Syria. This type of work has taken men of all ages, including boys as young as 11 or 12. Deri is ending his shift, carrying his day's findings of plastic bottles to store in a dedicated lot. Like many others in the country, Syrian or Lebanese, Deri is desperate to leave. I asked him, what are his dreams today?
The dream is Europe, but the reality is this. Everyone here dreams of leaving. We hope God can help us. We want to leave, to give the kids education and a better life. Inshallah.
Many Syrians feel that the world has let them down. And after 12 years, their hope for change, freedom and return home has vanished.
That report by Lina Sinjab. On Monday, Prince Harry appeared unexpectedly at the High Court here in London as legal proceedings in a privacy case between a newspaper publisher, the Prince, and a number of other high-profile figures got underway. The group, which includes the singer Sir Elton John, are suing Associated Newspapers, which publishes the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. The publisher denies the allegations and is trying to get them thrown out on the grounds that they're old and partly based on evidence given confidentially to a public inquiry which looked into media practices, including phone hacking. Tom Simons was at the hearing.
The arrival of Prince Harry and the actor Sadie Frost at the gates of the High Court appeared to be a deliberate attempt to send a message that they intend to accuse the Mail newspapers actively and in person. After all, today's hearing, legally technical, was only the first in what could be a very long battle in the courts, with a potential trial months away. Later, Sir Elton John and his husband David Furnish arrived, followed by Baroness Lawrence. Along with another actor, Liz Hurley, and the former MP Sir Simon Hughes, they accused journalists working for Associated Newspapers of paying private investigators to bug them, blag their information, and bribe police officials to obtain material for stories. In court, Harry listened intently, making brief notes as barristers for Associated Newspapers successfully argued for a restriction to prevent the media reporting some details of the case, including the names of 70 journalists allegedly involved. The publisher has vehemently denied the allegations, and this week will attempt to get them thrown out because they are old and partly based on evidence given confidentially to the Leveson inquiry 11 years ago.
Tom Simons. The United Nations has warned that the war in Ukraine has left about 30% of the country's territory contaminated. Asako Okai of the UN Development Programme, who's visited Ukraine, described it as one of the world's largest minefields. Simon Ponsford has the details.
The extent of the damage suffered by Ukraine, just over a year since Russia invaded, is startling. One big threat is from mines. The UN says about 10 million people are at risk. It estimates that 180,000 square kilometres of Ukrainian territory may be contaminated with explosives. That's an area about four times the size of Switzerland. Clearance could take decades. The UN says debris from more than a million destroyed houses also needs to be removed. Up to half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has been damaged.
Simon Ponsford. Lovers of the film classic The Wizard of Oz may recognise this.
This is the Wicked Witch of the West. She's worse than the other one was.
Who killed my sister?
Who killed the Witch of the East? Was it you?
No.
That scary voice was the Wicked Witch of the West, who's portrayed as a green-faced, crooked-nosed woman with a pointy black hat and broomstick, part of a tradition of often portraying villains as ugly, disfigured or disabled. This has long angered disability campaigners who object to outward deformity being used to indicate inner monstrosity. Now the leading author, Anthony Horowitz, who's been criticised for creating unsightly villains in the past, says he will make them more ordinary-looking in order to move with the times. Charlotte Gallagher takes up the story.
When you think of fictional villains, who comes to mind? Harry Potter's sworn enemy, Voldemort, James Bond's Blofeld, Shakespeare's physically disabled Richard III. They're just some of the baddies from books and films that have disfigurements or disabilities. There are countless others too. James Bond films in particular often feature an anti-hero who has facial scarring. The last three movies all had a villain with a disfigurement. Anthony Horowitz, who's also written new Bond novels, says the evil characters in his new book are all perfectly ordinary looking, as he's made a conscious effort to move with the times. The fellow children's author, Ross Montgomery, agrees.
Obviously, what they look like matters, but I think there are just so many ways to make them compelling. How they behave, you can focus on what they wear, you can focus on what they say and what they choose to say and what they choose to do. Like, if every single time you're writing a character who is lazy and a bit clumsy, and you find that you're also making them overweight at the same time, that's like a habit that people fall into quite a lot. When it comes to your villains, if every single time that you're writing them, you're trying to think up some kind of disfigurement so that the moment your character sees them, they're shocked at how ugly and strange and different they look, then it's probably a sign that, you know, there's maybe a better way of doing it. When people think about Bond villains, the first thing they'll probably think about is like Blofeld stroking a cat. And yeah, he's got a scar on his face as well. But it's the stroking the cat bit is the thing that makes it incredible. Like, that just really gets under your skin. It's really creepy. And I think it's a pity that we're kind of focusing on what you can't do anymore. Like, oh, I can't say that. Rather than focusing on, okay, well, what could I do that would be really interesting? How can I find a new way to do this that might be even more effective?
Several charities are calling for change too. Face Equality International says visible differences are often used as a visual shorthand to indicate a character is psychologically or morally damaged. They want to see characters with a scar or mark as positive role models, not the token bad guy.
Charlotte Gallagher. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Alison Davies. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Cyber
attack, enemy payments.
A series of increasingly sophisticated cybercrimes being carefully orchestrated around the world.
The attraction to target ATMs is fairly obvious. I mean, they're full of cash.
It was just like abracadabra. Put these cards, put any PIN number, and you get money.
Jackpot.
US investigators say the heists are being carried out by the Lazarus Group, a criminal hacking gang who are said to be working under the orders of the North Korean state.
Tens of millions of dollars for the North Koreans.
These actors are not as anonymous as they think they are.
The group's goal? To steal money to help fund the country's growing ballistic missile and nuclear program.
But despite evidence suggesting otherwise, North Korea denies any involvement.
In season two of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service, we're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
And piles of stolen cash.
Over $2 billion. We're at $2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.